Hey, buttheads! Welcome to the show, Bob Zemeckis is Not a Butthead. I'm Richard. I'm with my buddy Kyle.
We don't need roads.
Richard, we don't need roads. What strange and winding roads have brought us here today, Richard? Both of us still under quarantine, me in Southern California, you in San Francisco, and we're here to talk about, what are we here to talk about, Richard?
I want to hold your hand. Bob Zemeckis' first feature.
Yes. And more broadly, we're on a mission. We're on a mission of sorts. And what is that mission, Richard?
We're taking an odyssey through the filmography of Bob Zemeckis to just talk about how awesome his movies are.
Yeah, man. Rad. No, it was funny. We were hanging out in line somewhere and you were talking about we had talked for years, bounced around the idea of doing a movie podcast. And when you said doing Bob Zemeckis, I thought, that's perfect. Because the one thing that sucks about doing a movie podcast is it looks like you're trying to be cool. And there's no filmmaker you could make a film podcast about where you get less cool cred than doing one about Bob Zemeckis. And for that reason alone, we are the two idiots who are here to do that, to talk about Bob Zemeckis. But why, Richard?
I think
why?
Here's the thing. I have heard people kind of talk poorly of him and not be excited about him as a filmmaker, and that surprises me because he's made so many good things that we all love from our childhood. Back to the Future, obviously, Roger Rabbit and Contact and Castaway, and then there's this like sticking point with Forrest Gump for people where that had an enormous backlash.
Well, I think that comes from the time it was released, but we'll get to that.
Totally.
I'm sure eventually.
And there's a bunch of like people looking at it with like a modern, like the lens of now and being like, ugh, about certain parts. All to say, like, I think there's a lot to learn from watching start to finish. Like, watch him develop as a director.
Indeed.
So that's what I'm excited to do.
Yeah, and there's this, I think it was what I found interesting, why I thought it would be cool, like because I'm back in the day, because Richard and I, you and I, we went to film school together, UT Austin, fucking right there, put him up.
Horns.
That's right. And we both live in California, like a bunch of, like, just traitors. Yeah, that's true. That's right. Oh, shit, hold on. Did you hear that, Richard?
No, barely.
That was a phone call. We're going to edit that part out. There was a phone. It was a scam call that interrupted the thing. Okay, anyway, we went to school together, UT Austin, et cetera. And I've lost my train of thought, Richard. That phone call threw me.
Oh, it's okay. But, yeah, we met at UT and lived together for many years in shittier and shittier apartments as time went forward. And we made a lot of films together, both in college and after college.
Yes, indeed. And now we are here to talk about Bob Zemeckis. And why are we here to talk about Bob Zemeckis? Because
he's not a butthead.
Exactly. Yes, that we'll get to the title in a second. But I think that what was interesting to us about it was the fact that when we would talk to people about, and we kind of, I admittedly fell victim to this myself, like the concept Bob Zemeckis felt uncool in the wake of, you know, your Polar Expresses and your Christmas Carols. So you felt like there was the concept Bob Zemeckis felt somehow uncool, and yet, you know, when you would bring up various individual Bob Zemeckis films, you would get this outpouring of just joy and love and admiration, like Back to the Future, or even some people have an affinity for Death Becomes Her. It's a very strange film, or Romancing the Stone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All these things, Roger Rabbit, I mean, again, as you put some of these things together and you say, well, he's clearly a filmmaker to have a conversation about, and yet, If I say I'm going to do a film, when I say I'm going to do a podcast about the films of Bob Zemeckis, I've said it to a few filmmaker friends of mine. All I get is exactly.
Why?
Why? And we're here to answer that question one episode at a time, Richard.
I think it's also like even starting to get into what I want to hold your hand is there's just, as opposed to like making high art, like that seems to have never been his goal at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's like silly running into trash gags and silly spit gags and anything throwing dimes at shit. All just very, very silly things, which of course starts with I Want to Hold Your Hand, which they always pitched as American Graffiti meets Ben-Hur, because mm-hmm. you never see Jesus's face in Ben-Hur. I love that pitch. But yeah, I Want to Hold Your Hand. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was the wild card, certainly, because we, when we're talking about doing you were very committed early on to the idea of doing all of his films start to finish, which means kind of leading off here with, a film that I had never seen prior to.
Yeah, or heard of, probably.
Yeah, exactly. That felt very adjacent to the story of Bob Zemeckis that we all know and love, and with Romancing the Stone and Back to the Future and all of those things. So it was interesting because, and yet, going in very uncertain, I found myself really liked the movie, enjoyed it, was fascinated by it, and in a lot of ways, and feel like I have a lot to say about it. What was your experience, Richard?
I was, it kind of went in phases where I was expecting this like small indie movie that he just kind of made. And mm-hmm. then when we were talking, doing an earlier practice episode, which may be released later, you watched the trailer. I hadn't even watched the trailer. And mm-hmm. so you clicked on the trailer and you go, oh, this is a real movie, which mm-hmm. immediately I was like, wait, it's not this indie thing. This is a studio thing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
then you learn that it's his only Criterion release, and you're like, wait a second, what?
That's right. God damn it. I mean, if anyone questions why we're doing this, I mean, there you go. The goddamn Criterion Collection released this film, released a film of the Bob Zemeckis. And while I'm sure many of his films deserve that honor, if you give a shit about that at all, which I don't, but
neither
if you did, say, theoretically give a shit about any of that, yeah, sure, let's throw fucking Roger Rabbit deserves a goddamn Criterion edition.
Yeah, absolutely.
Doesn't you piece of shit, Richard?
I agree with you.
Yeah, that's right. Don't disagree with me. But no, that's the thing, is that I found myself quite taken with it, and also just let's start this off, because I feel like there's no way to talk about the movie without talking about this. It was a profoundly sexual film. It was from start to finish. It was literally a film about, in essence, the female orgasm for 90 minutes of like foreplay leading up to orgasm, and every one of the girls' trajectories, each one of her stories, as it pushes through to the end. We'll get to what the plot is in just one second, as to how it achieves this. It's pushing towards something about her awakening sexuality, and that all kind of writ large in the moment just sort of bursts forward as this fantastic metaphor for quite literally the sexuality bursting forth in the 60s from the sort of kind of Victorian sensibility that had characterized the previous 100 years. And it's just done as this like screaming, angry, fast, visceral Chuck Jones cartoon that builds into a Beatles music video at the end. And it's with all sorts of little Bob Zemeckis Easter eggs and quotations that you would see show up in later films popping in. And I don't know, I was just very taken with it. And then ultimately even taken with how explicit it made all of its relationships between like the sexual subtext and the text. It gets very explicit near the end, but we'll get to that. To one of my favorite shots in Bob Zemeckis' entire filmography now, which happens with Nancy Allen at the end, but we'll get to that.
I'm sure you do.
So just to sum up the plot, so how does Bob Zemeckis take us on this orgasmatronic journey towards just a big cum explosion at the end of this thing? How does it happen, Richard?
The Beatles are about to play the Ed Sullivan Show, and four teenage girls go in with the goal of sneaking into the hotel room that the Beatles are staying at to catch a glimpse of them. They convince some boy whose father is an undertaker, who has a learner's permit, to steal his limo to drive them from New Jersey to New York so they could get a sight of the Beatles.
Yes. Maybe. And these girls, some of them are rather enthusiastic about the Beatles.
They have a touch
of that that Beatlemania that's going around, which literally almost like a zombie film you start see is it almost appears like an affliction going through this whole thing.
Right.
The Beatlemania, where you see the one girl who's literally just vibrating, shaking and crying, says, "If John Lennon doesn't marry me, I'm going to kill myself." And she drops to her knees sobbing. That was fun.
Which is great. And in the middle of that's the master for that whole sequence. There's a whole other half of that scene that happens, which is just totally a Zemeckis thing, an overly complicated, big master shot with several jokes in it.
Yes.
That should never be played in that that way, really.
Yeah.
But he pulls it off.
Yes, but let's get to it. Yeah. So the girls, they're all so they don't even have tickets yet. They need to get tickets. Everyone in the world is trying to get inside that studio. You know, the world is on fire with Beatlemania. Everyone's trying, and like you see the little I love all the little details, and you see that's I'm sure kind of comes from the lived experience of having been in that period, but it gave so much character to that, of like the people selling the little Beatles
bed sheet
swatches, claiming they slept on them, or the guy Eddie Deason, who I'm sure we'll talk about in a minute, ripping up the carpet because they walked on it, and all this sort of insanity that's going on.
I love that gag when she runs around and there's just a wide shot of a kid ripping up carpet. It's so silly stupid and funny and beautiful. But yes, they get to the hotel. They each somehow get a ticket to the thing. And then the big show. But the movie like branches off and becomes this very complicated juggling act where there's four different parallels. Each of the girls kind of has their own parallel story through the thing. One of them running through the hotel. One of them accidentally gets snuck into their room. One of them is with a greaser kid trying to protest everything.
Yeah, and I love, and everyone's trajectory is really interesting. You know, like especially, I mean, most the biggest and most interesting one being Nancy Allen, who, you know, of course, in the beginning, her thread through this is just so interesting, because in the beginning she denies even liking the Beatles, because she's about to get she's the good girl who's engaged, she has the ring on her finger, she's marrying the good guy literally the next day. Everything's at 10 in this fucking movie, and that's what I kind of dig about it. She's literally getting married the next day to some guy, and she doesn't like the Beatles because he doesn't like the Beatles. He doesn't want her to think she would like the Beatles because, oh, he'll think I'm not serious if I'm into that sort of thing.
She wants Tupperware instead of the Beatles record. That's
exactly
what she wants.
Exactly. And so, while several of the other characters are ravenous, passing out, jumping out of car Beatle fans, not so. She's not interested, but she, of course, is the one that, you know, because she gets onto a dessert cart in like some kind of fucking cartoon or like Jerry Lewis movie, she fucking ends up inside of the Beatles room. And that's when both, you know, purely through one single shot and then many more shots that then follow, but through one fantastic shot, he both reveals the core of who her character is and what that orientation means, like what that makes kind of the subtext explicit, where she's in the Beatles room. What does this mean? And he pulls back with just tons of anticipation, lots of foreplay and anticipation, pulls back. So kind of on the left Z axis, all the Beatles equipment sort of like creeps into frame, and you see her like quivering and reaching towards the, like they
she's
make,
crawling towards it. She's
just crawling towards it.
She like faints down, crawls towards it on her knees.
On her hands and knees. And she crawls directly towards Paul's base, which is a dick. And without saying anything, because remember, textually at the end, she is in love with Paul and like literally kind of fucks him in the studio, which we'll get to in a second. But it's all revealed towards how she crawls towards the thing, touches, and then literally like inserts of lips. She's like kissing the base. Everything. And then in the next shot, when she's crawling through the room eating stuff, she's just dragging the bass with her. She's gone completely carnal, because it's like the Beatles are for her like Heathcliff, the Phantom of the Opera, you know, the bad boy greaser that steals her away from the good boy. She has this wild love affair with the absent Beatles, which is
great.
Funny,
it's so
because
great.
Of course, because the whole movie is about their absence, you know, the absence of their faces, and the fact that you tease the music at the beginning and then you hold on to it, and then you have this big orgasmic explosion of Beatles music at the end. But yeah, so it's all, you have this fantastic like sexual sequence with the bass, and all of that, and then how that just continues to play out through her arc. You know, she's literally confronted where she becomes the face of like the biggest Beatles fans, and she becomes a thing, and then her boyfriend shows up and she turns him down just to go and get into the show. And then when she gets in, well, we'll get to what happens when we get into the show. I want to save that.
Right.
Tease that out a little bit longer, Richard. But some of the other characters are also great.
I loved the photographer so much.
Oh, she was fantastic. Yeah,
she was my favorite, who has her own kind of thing where she wants to get, wants to snap photos of the thing to sell them to Life magazine.
Yes,
maybe.
Yes.
And
she's the ambitious
plan.
One.
It's her she's plan. It's yeah. who gets she's, the limo. She seduces the boy to get the limo.
Mm-hmm.
She's the one who has the plan to get them into the hotel.
For sure. She's the only one who doesn't give a shit about the Beatles. And her thing is purely ambition. You know, she wants to use the Beatles. She wants to use Beatlemania, you know, to elevate herself. So she's all about just snapping those pictures. And I think that what's interesting is, you know, it seems kind of strange when all the kids are supposed to show up at the big, you know, concert at the end that she's not present, but then outside. You realize that, yeah, she has, her story is not about that. Her story is about, you know, does she, because she's shitting on Jimmy Olsen, literally Jimmy Olsen from fucking Superman. Yep. She's shitting on Jimmy Olsen like fucking Margot Kidder the whole goddamn time. And then finally at the end, when he's just fucking had enough and she's stepped on him the whole goddamn movie, and he's totally a prelude to Crispin Glover. He even gets the line, get your damn hands off her.
Get your goddamn hands off her.
Exactly. Yeah, he's just a prelude to Crispin Glover.
The
same line. But let's like she finally decides to choose not to go in and get the career advancing thing, the material success, and instead go back and help him. And then, of course, by virtue of doing that, she gets the material success. And there is that thing, which we'll get to in a minute. But that's another whole interesting aspect of this movie that kind of is a prelude to Back to the Future in some kind of fun ways. But anyway, yeah, her cold character was fantastic. But I like that her ending, it would have been easy just to have her show up, run in, be excited with all of the other girls, and just have her arc go nowhere. No, they gave her the appropriate ending for her individual trajectory in that movie in a really cool way.
Agreed. And she also has her weird, lewd sexual sequence where
which is the patty cake beat from Roger Rabbit.
Yes.
Literally the patty cake beat from Roger Rabbit. It's in the same way that, like, apparently, like, Spielberg did the, I'm sure everyone's heard this, you know, the whole coat hanger gag in Raiders of the Lost Ark. He originally tried to do it in 1941, and then, you know, it became leftovers that he then used in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And you see him, like, there's something he's trying to do with the whole mustard head gag, the picnic basket instead. And he's like, he didn't quite get it. So then when he did Roger Rabbit, he then got the chance to actually do it right with the with that. Anyway, so.
But rad. Yes, I love that whole sequence where you just, that the exchange between her and Jimmy Olsen at that table where, like, she's getting him drunk and just tells him to sit there and continue to get drunk as she's overhearing this guy about how she's going to get the $50 to sneak back in, who is obviously some kind of weird, creepy pervert. And she looks at him and goes, she asked for a college co-ed, and then she looks at Jimmy Olsen and says, hey, do I look like I'm in college? And she says, do I look like I'm in college? And he goes, yeah, you get good grades, which is the funniest inversion. Yeah, you get good grades.
Yeah, that's so good. But that, like, that level of naivete, that it's not about her body or her physicality. Do I look like college? It's like, yeah, you're smart. Just such innocence. Yeah, that's great. Well, that's what's interesting. See that, and this is a whole other thing. I don't know. It's just bizarre because the it's like, I was thinking about the fact that, like, this film has this great sequence, which kind of is a prelude to the patty cake sequence later in Roger Rabbit, where whatever her name is, the photographer girl, Sally Meatballs, I'm going to call her that.
Sure.
But she's in there and she's in the closet and she's watching shit. And it's very similar to the scene from Blue Velvet, you know, where Kyle MacLachlan is sitting in the closet and watching, and his sort of innocent pre-sexual revolution kind of naivete is burst by him seeing the horrors that are in the room in that film. And then the same thing here, we have this interesting juxtaposition between what is ultimately revealed to be kind of silly and ridiculous, but for a substantial period of time prior to that, we're essentially led to believe that Sally Meatballs is just like watching just a girl her age just get out by some older guy, and like the image is flashing across her eyes. And so that's like, he's putting that in this film that's already, you know, like a crazy amount of sexual
about to burst. Burst. Yeah.
He's putting that shit in your head. Yeah. And I was just thinking about, it's interesting because in that way, because he's all making this film about this big transformative moment, you know, and I'd never drawn this connection before, but it made me more, honestly, Richard, on this, our first episode, it made me more excited about doing this whole podcast, was thinking about the fact that right around the same time that this film was being made, David Lynch was making Eraserhead, and thinking about those two trajectories, David Lynch and Bob Zemeckis right on top of each other, connected by the scene, because they're playing with similar images, you know, the idea of the innocent, kind of from the pre-sexual revolution person, kind of witnessing sexual shit through a peephole and all of that. You know, it's, they're playing with similar ideas. David Lynch is obviously using it to affect, you know, horror, all sorts of weird shit. Bob Zemeckis is using it here in a way that, you know, as you can see kind of where these same images are repurposed later in Roger Rabbit, he took it with a different energy. Roger Rabbit and Blue Velvet are slightly different films.
Very different.
But just thinking about that, thinking about those two things in parallel, it just was interesting because I realized that in a way, you know, David Lynch, I mean, this is true of many people from the film, the kind of film brat era in and around and before, but just to look at David Lynch, Jason, to Bob Zemeckis in isolation for a moment, they both really deal with this idea that, you know, the mythologization, that's the right word, right? I said it right.
Mythologizing
of this, mythologizing of the self or of, you know, America in the 20th century through this prism or this portal of the television, you know, was transformative and potentially created a corrupting lie that under which there was a lot of blah 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 blah. So that's Lynch's trajectory through this whole thing, and then looking at that relative to where Back to the Future, which would also juxtapose, you know, the 50s with the contemporary moment in the same way that Blue Velvet would juxtapose, you know, 50s images and music with that contemporary moment, the 1980s. It's interesting it's interesting to look at this light and dark reflection that I'm seeing emerge just because of that one Peeping Tom scene. But seems to kind of connect those two filmmakers.
Even beyond the Peeping Tom moment, where she's also watching the Ed Sullivan Show, in addition to that. So it's explicitly about the sex, but also the television in the background. And you even have he's wrote in a moment where the greaser character climbs the tower with an axe to prevent the show from being broadcast. Talking about the corrupting influence.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah.
You have like the almost the intention of the one of the characters to disrupt.
Yes, exactly. It's just like the end of Cable Guy. Even that, it's like even every character's trajectory aligns perfectly with this whole like idea of this emergent sexuality, because like even look at whatever his name is, Smirko or whatever, that guy's in Night Shift. That I was like watching, I'm like, where do I know this guy from? Like, there's a movie I've seen a bunch of times that he's in, and it was Night Shift. Yeah, he plays like the goofy son, Henry Winkler, to the Night Shift. But even his trajectory is he's the tough guy from this sort of pre-1960s paradigm, you know. And what does he say when he sits down? Why does he take issue with the Beatles? He's like, I have hit on. He basically says, like, what did he say? I've hit on seven girls tonight. He doesn't say hit on. He uses a different term, but he basically says, I've hit on seven girls tonight. And what do they all say? They're interested in Beatles. So he is worried about this new paradigm shift stopping it, because it's basically going to render his masculinity just completely impotent. And then now girls are going to want something new. So at the end, he's literally with axe in hand, like climbing up the tower, trying to like chop the thing down, trying to stop it. And then what happens? He ends up falling down, ends up getting struck by lightning. He ends up macking on the girl who's sort of the opposite of that, the most like the girl who's
the Joan Baez
chick, type, you know, yeah. Who will get. And yes, I'm sure. Yeah. So, and anyway, so that's just a whole, and it's just fun, you know, it's like, again, everything, it's that. you know, because what started the whole conversation about having this was this beautiful alignment, this almost kind of this wonderful alignment of elements in Back to the Future that makes it kind of a magical film that whisks you away. And then you can see just so much of that, like, level of sort of alignment of character and just theme, and then the underlying kind of metaphor, and the whole film being this funny joke because it hides the Beatles' faces while, you know, teasing them the whole time and teasing the music in the same way that the film is so about sex and orgasms and everything the whole time, while never really having any of that content in the film, really. I mean, the shot of Nancy Allen that I'm sure we'll get to really pushes, yeah, that rides that line there at the end. But and then it's like, oh, right, it would make sense that this guy got the future. It would make sense that, like, it's like it's like the swimming pool he was in. And I mean, as many filmmakers have to do, you know, it's like, okay, well, I've done something good. This is what I'm good at. What can I can do this thing. I can, what's a good script or a good concept? So a guy who would did this, it makes so much sense that he would say, fucking time travel movie, right? Yes. You know, like, right, affecting this period. Than that, you know, there was some reason to go back there again, and even though it's a different time period, which I think also has to do with potentially why this, at least for me, certainly was overlooked, was the fact that it, you know, this was remembering a period that was like, what, like 13 years in the past, yeah, or something.
Not that long before.
Yeah, but math
and burps.
Yes, exactly. You got it, you piece of shit. I'm kind of ignorant of the conditions under which the film came. It's kind of baffled by the existence of the movie in certain ways.
I can answer some of those.
But you have that, and okay, so it doesn't, let's just say it doesn't, you know, not certainly has not connected in the way Back to the Future has. It was a different kind of film. But then you have Back to the Future, which is a slightly different alignment of time periods. It's not 1978 remembering the early 60s, it's 1980s remembering the 50s, and suddenly the poles align, and suddenly, you know, the values of the 80s and the values of the 50s align in such a way so that brand of Zemeckis, you know, nostalgia, like, he found his moment. And it's so interesting to see this in so many ways as a prelude. I mean, literally to the fact that, like, you know, as we said before, Jimmy Olsen has the Crispin Glover moment. There is the bolt of lightning striking, just like at the end of Back to the Future. There's a big bolt of lightning. He's playing with these images, and he wants to figure out something to do with them. Like, he's thinking about it already, and it's going to take him a couple more films to finally find a home for all of them. And it's kind of really interesting to see this as a prelude to those films in that way.
And just even, that's just looking at, like, a purely conceptual screenplay level. But you can start to see all of his, the kind of birth of all the things that will define him later. A lot of really long takes, a lot of, you can tell he's working on timing of gags in this. There's a lot of, like, jumping in front of camera, or somebody hides and then a door opens, and the timing is almost there.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about that yet, but how the whole film is just this crazy kind of live action cartoon. I mean, you could say it's a cartoon, but you could also just say it's comedy done in a style from just a few decades before, where you
screwball.
Could just hold an screwball, or just have you just, where you could hold an something that would be far more familiar to the era of Blake Edwards than than basically what was going on. It's like Blake Edwards sort of in the Pink Panther days, more so than in the in 1978. But these big master shots, these cool frames where you would just have people hiding behind things, popping out of closets, ducking behind shit, comedy playing while someone's ducking around behind someone. It's just fun stuff that plays out like that, as opposed to, say, just a bunch of jokes.
Right, and I watched some of the special features where they talked about that specific, like, the joke thing specifically, because Bob Gale is a great storyteller. He's like the guy who remembers all this shit. But he was talking about writing the thing, and just goes very specifically to that point. It's not, there's not jokes in the movie. All the comedy is derived from the characters and their situation. So the things they say are not jokes. They are funny in context of the moment. And that's how they've always written things. And also, in terms of, like, speaking of the feeling at home in a different era, they talked a lot about how They're very inspired by Frank Capra's work, and that faster is funnier. Faster is funnier, and you can feel that play out.
Yes,
so much in like the in basically so any scene, But like the first one where she runs and throws the dimes at the phone booth, like, and they're all packed in the phone booth together, and it's just like they are. It's the scene happens so fast and so beautifully, and it just holds in whatever a master can be inside a phone booth. But you have three heads all delivering lines at each other, just rapid fire, and the jokes are just coming because you're not giving anybody time enough to react to them. Like, you have to hear them.
I was a big fan of how many heads were in the frame for much of the movie. So many heads. Richard, you know me.
You like heads?
You know that I like seeing many heads in the frame at the time at one time, and there were plenty of, especially with the awesome and some of the handsomer scenes with the cars in the film with those big bench seats just filling out the frame, all three heads in the front seat. Oh, so many heads in the frame. The frames are better with more heads in them, Rich.
They always are.
I'm just going to say it.
They always are. I completely agree.
Or just a lot of one head. Either way.
And just even thinking about the, like, they maxed out their use of extras, and you can definitely tell they're like,
I mean, that's why I'm just baffled by the existence of this film. Like, it's like, what, like, where you're just sort of like, Jesus Christ, you know, it's just like, look at how many people they had to work with.
No, yeah, sorry, like, but like, they have a whole mass of people out in front of the hotel to kind of give the sense of the hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is my favorite, but you didn't guess it, but I love the part where they pull up, they finally get the limo to sneak past.
Mm-hmm.
The part that stuck with me the most is the greaser kid wearing the wig, sticking his head out of the limo, screaming, "Yeah, yeah, yeah, I want to hold your glands."
Oh, I know.
Which incites
No. It's even, "I want to hold your gland."
I love how he says that. I want to hold
the
your
most
gland.
The most grating fucking note.
I love that part so much, and then that kicks off the running. That kicks them off running into the hotel, and then you have Jimmy Olsen like bouncing in the seat, and there's literally a pile of faces in every window, and he's just crying.
Just talk about by the way, the fact that like Jimmy Smirko's entrance, literally climbing from window to window while driving, you know, I'm just every this character screaming, just everything, all the perform. Like, I just found myself wondering at times, like, how do you get performers to just output that level of energy for the whole movie? You know,
Just constantly.
Oh, it's crazy.
They're moving fast and they're doing a lot. And he didn't have video assist.
Yes.
Like, and they're all just kind of bouncing around together. Holy cow. True story. I wrote this down as that him jumping from car to car. I did that between boats once.
He's different with boats because water.
I leapt between two ski boats.
Yes.
And
how
nearly,
fast were they going?
Yeah, 20 miles an hour. I would have gotten totally sucked into that propeller, though. I did it very dumbly.
Oh, well, you shouldn't have done that then, Richard.
I like was hanging off the side of the boat. Like I did, I thought I could make it, then I didn't make it. And
Richard,
then
why did you do this? Let me guess, Richard. Was alcohol involved?
No, this was pre-booze.
What?
I was like, yeah, I was like 16.
Okay, so this is just you being a dumb kid. I knew that dumbness was involved. I just didn't know the brand of dumbness. It was
young dumb. Kind of.
Anyone below the age of, I'm going to say 27, is basically drunk all the time.
Yeah.
You know, drunk to the point of unconsciousness. I certainly was. I don't think I came online until like 27, 28 fully. I don't really remember what happened before that.
A lot of Miller High Life.
a lot of Miller High Life, actually.
Gross amount.
Yep.
But yes, all the big heads and just him having to pull out of that that army of people just bouncing, nervous. He doesn't know what to do. And he's like going up on the curb. I love that shot with just all of their faces stuck up against the glass with him.
Yes, and then I guess it's finally time we talk about Beatles super fan. I don't know any of their names. I don't understand
her
names.
Her name in the movie was Paula? Pam? Doesn't
Jesus, Richard.
No, I don't remember.
this is the kind of professionalism you'll get here.
Wendy Jo Sperber is her actual name. the actress's name, who is the super fan who has my favorite gag of throwing dimes at the phone booth, which I've mentioned so many times. It's a fistful of dimes and then just immediately starts dialing.
Yes. And just her energy is just
big.
Is just the thing.
Big.
Yes, it's like in the dynamic range of the film, she is the peaks. You know, the valleys happen periodically, but the peaks of in already a film where everyone's at 10, she is at 11 the entire time. And can we talk for a second just about that stunt where she jumps out of the car? I literally rewound it just to watch. Again, A, that's a fucking impressive stunt, because whatever the stunt person is or whatever ate shit on the way out, just like ass first, backwards.
It's
like,
surprising. It is legit surprising in the movie.
And the reason it's legit surprising, and I noticed this when I watched it through the second time, is it's not that the movement is in no way initiated in the first shot. So the interior of the car. So in the interior, it's not initiated at all. So they're just screaming. You're assuming that all the action's going to stay inside. You have no idea. You don't see her go for the door. There's not an insert of her grabbing the handle.
Exterior.
You just cut to the exterior of the car. The door foams over and then
boom,
and she
falls out. Shit.
And it is. And it shocked me. And it's that kind of thing that it was just the perfect frame to set up that stunt, because the stunt just happens. Boom. She's dumped out in the middle of the frame and you're staring right at it and it just hits you with maximal impact. And then she bounces up like it's a goddamn cartoon. Yep. And I fucking loved that. That was rad.
They talked about that a little bit on the special features. Apparently, all the stunt people, when they were coordinating it, were like, Bob, can we have her fall into a pile of boxes or some garbage, or can the car slow down?
Tell me about the stunt.
Yeah. So they tried to convince him. They were like, no, she's got to fall into something. The stunt person has to fall into something, because no one's going to think it's funny if she just eats shit. And Zemeckis was like, no, it'll work. And sure as shit, it certainly does.
And I think it works because she's such a little cartoon character.
Right.
She's shorter than everyone else. She has the huge features. You know, she's screaming the whole time. Yeah. And so you believe that she could just jump out of the car, bounce off the ground, and pop back up. And I think that it's a kind of an interesting thing where you're right. Normally, it would be the kind of thing where, especially in a comedy, it's not an action sequence. To see that would kind of take you out of the movie. Maybe it did. I don't know, but it would be the fourth wall a little bit or whatever. But at the same time, it's just like, I don't know. At no point did I think like, oh no, she's hurt. I was just like, yeah, it makes sense. Her character would bounce like that.
And I think this is part of why I'm curious to watch these movies, is that specific thing. I was like, how does that moment work? That it should be this like chaos danger moment that is played slightly as such for the characters in the car, because they have a reaction to it. But this thing that should, and even his crew was like, this isn't going to play as a comedy.
Yep.
And then like suddenly the danger is bottomed out. I think it's like you said, she's a cartoon. She immediately stands up and runs at the phone booth. So it is Looney Tunes territory at that point. She's definitely not hurt, but it is so wonderful and surprising to see her absolutely leap out of the car that is moving.
It's just a great stunt too. It's like backwards out of a car onto cement, ass first, and just all right in the middle of the frame. You know, it's funny, I went to go see Freebie and the Bean at the New Beverly before we got quarantined and they canceled all the rest of the movies, and that's just a movie that has just some of the coolest and most impressive stunts. And it just instant chase sequences and all this kind of shit. Anyway, but it made me appreciate how the impact again of just seeing a good stunt executed clearly in the middle of the frame and the impact it can have if it's well placed within a story and you understand why it's happening. And it's just like, and of course, Freebie and the Bean just has that like over and over and over and over and over again for the whole runtime, and that's why the movie's rad. With this, just that one moment, I was just like, I didn't rewind it because I'm like, oh no, did you know the girl eat shit? What happened? I rewound it because I just wanted to see it again. Like it was an expulsion of joy that came out of me when I saw. I was like, one more time.
Same. You know?
And then,
I also wanted to
understand, like, why did that take me so off guard? Was I not paying attention? And then, no, it's because, like, there's zero indication in the first shot. It's just the cut. It's everything's in the car, and then it cuts to an exterior, and ka-dunk, and she gets dumped out.
And the phone booth. The phone booth is right there in frame.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So you have, and I think that's part of it too. Yeah, it's like she's talking. She got to get to a phone. Got to get to a phone. I'm going to jump out of the car. I'm going to jump out of the car. And I think that's probably also why it functions as comedy, is you have her threatening it, or you have her threatening it. And as an audience, they're like, hey, look at this movie. This character is not going to leap out of this car.
Yes.
They don't have money for stunts.
And this is the other thing, is that the whole film kind of is like it's a lot like The Hangover. It's a lot like a gang of guys going out to get laid movie, except it's a gang of guys going out to get laid movie, except the sex, the getting laid, is getting in to see the Beatles, where they all have their experiences, which we'll get to. We're going to, just like this movie, we're going to save talking about the act, what happens in the studio, a lot like what happens in Vegas, whereas The Hangover takes place. It's all connected, Richard.
Hooray!
Hooray! We'll save that for the end. We're teasing that. But you know, you have Superfan, and she's the Bradley Cooper. She's like, I'm getting to Paul. She's like, I'm getting laid. She's like, I'm getting in there. She's going to run through a brick wall to, you know, make shit happen. And then you have your nerdy adjacent character, who's the ambitious girl who is maybe down to party, but it's sort of a kind
who
of
decides adjacent. Who decides that she's going to be down.
Yes.
In one of my favorite moments. Yeah.
What I enjoy is that, like, by the way, it's like she's adjacent to that duality, because there's that opening shot when they go into the record store, and so you see like the hive of Beatlemania.
Right.
She's not in that shot. It's just Superfan and Nancy Allen, who I only call Nancy Allen because she's Nancy Allen from fucking RoboCop. She was married to Brian De Palma, Richard. You know,
right?
She's in Blowout, and
she was in all
Blowout,
that kind of
shit.
And I knew she looked familiar.
Yeah. And but mostly she's like, Murphy. I'm a mess.
I'm a mess.
Murphy. I'm a mess. God, I love that fucking movie. So anyway, what was I talking about a second ago? Nancy Allen. So the shot that brings them in holds just the two of them, and so that's the fundamental opposition. There's the I'm going out, like, I'm getting laid tonight guy. That's the super fan, and she's like, I'm blocking it, like, Paul now, just in me, you know. And then you have the girl who's like, I don't want that at all, and
a boyfriend,
the completely disposable guy who I think the Hangover removed. I haven't seen The Hangover in front, it's the first thing I can think of, but there's many other similar films. But the point is, like,
Superbad.
Exactly. She's the good girl, whatever. But the point being that, like, the sex is just getting into the Beatles show. The sex is getting in there, you know, but it's just, which is great, because it perfectly aligns with that genre. And it almost doesn't make sense in the beginning, in a film about Beatlemania, that Nancy Allen would say, I don't like the Beatles at all. And you're like, well, why are you in this movie then? And you realize that it's just her denial of, no, I'm getting married. I'm saving myself. I don't have sexual desires. And then when she arrives into the den of temptation, where she, you know, where this big fucking phallus of a base is, we see, and I just love that there's no lines, no words. There's that long shot of her emerging foot first out of the
from
cart.
The thing.
And I think they cut it up a little bit. I can't remember if it's all, I don't think it's all one shot, but
just knocking all
back,
the bottles,
so,
the
all the bottles,
bottles
off. Yeah, yeah.
And, yeah,
which
yeah.
is such a great, again, in that you could, where again, you see those, like, that note card screenwriting of Back to the Future there, where it's like, oh, they mentioned the Coke bottle, the Coke and bourbon before, and there's the Coke and bourbon indicating she's in the Beatles film, which tips the audience off, which is great, because the way that the shot is, it's basically a shot of just a white wall. And so just that little setup and payoff tips the audience off. So the audience is ahead of her in that moment. And because the audience is ahead of her in that moment, as the camera pulls back, we only see her face, and we only see her face reacting to the realization that she's in the Beatles room. And now our mind's reeling, because now we're like, what the fuck is being revealed? And it's that.
Paul's face is a dick.
Exactly. And it's that great quality. It's that great quality that Spielberg's Wonders and everything have, of just continuous revelation. And that it's basically like, oh, we're in the Beatles room, and then she gets out, so now we're anticipating what she's going to see. Then we see her face, and now we want to see what she's reacting to. Then we see what she's reacting to. But she said she didn't like the Beatles. So now, And then when we see how she reacts to the bass, which is, again, where things get like, it's the moment, I think, and quite literally, it's like where the, to get sexual for a moment, it's like where the membrane gets pierced, if you will, in the sense that that's where the kind of brewing sexual subtext, which is there under the Beatlemania thing, becomes with just a shaft, just a thick, fucking hard shaft. At bass, and she's her trembling fingers touching that big thick shaft. And I mean, I don't remember, but like the way I remember that scene is like it cutting to like insert shots of her like trembling lips and shit. I don't remember if that's what actually happens.
I think it's one cutaway to her hand. I think
the hand on those thick fucking bass strings. Those just but it's like everything you know about her, the fact that her character was a lie that was suppressing is all in just this one pullback. And you're like, that's fucking dope, you know?
So good. Yes, I wrote that down as your favorite part, the Paul's bass is a dick part.
Yes. Oh, well, you're close. Silver metal, close but no cigar. It's the Nancy Allen shot at the end, which we'll get to in a moment. But
That makes sense. It's the corollaries.
Yes, they certainly are. You know what I like, Richard.
I do. What's funny about...
I like Nancy Allen.
There's a special feature on the disc where Nancy Allen is talking about that scene with the bass. And she said she was really nervous to shoot it. And Zemeckis had to like pull her aside and be like, oh, no, it's about... It's about
rad. Tell me everything about this right now.
It's about the changing of the time period and advancing of the culture, and it's just about all these big societal changes. That's what this moment is about. And he just kind of gave her big high level stuff and was like being very like kid gloves, apparently. Just like, it's just about the changing of the times and what it represents and all this. And she was really nervous on the day, and he is not lying.
It is about all that stuff. It totally is.
He calms her back down on set, and then Spielberg walks in and goes, "Oh, you're shooting the blah blah scene."
What's blah blah?
I don't know. That's what Nancy Allen said. She's like, "I'm not going to say what he said, but." Like it's the guitar
fucking
scene.
It's the cock-based scene.
Exactly.
The guitar fucking scene.
And then he had to, Zemeckis, like, that Spielberg announced that very loudly on set.
Yes.
And so Zemeckis had to go up to him and be like, I just calmed her down.
It's just like that moment in State in Maine, you know, when they have to calm down as Sarah Jessica Parker's character to show her boobs or whatever. Then she walks back out, and then all of a sudden the crew guy is like, I don't see what her big problem is. They can draw her tits from memory. And then she runs back in and slams the door.
I have to say, so I did buy the Criterion for this just to see on a whim. And oh my God, the stories that they tell about the movie and the early career, totally worth it. Totally word. Worth it.
Word. Dude, I want to watch that stuff. I went in completely cold. I haven't looked up one thing, and I didn't watch anything. So I literally just finished it a few minutes before we finished. I watched about an hour of it last night, and I was just passing out because I'd been writing all day. And so I just watched the last 30 minutes of it today. And it was so funny. It was interesting to take that gap. Because I'm in quarantine. I mean, I would love to have seen it another way, but I don't like watching things on laptops. I can only do it for so long. It was interesting because I got to go to bed with one impression of a movie that was like playfully teasing all of this, sexual revolution subtext. By last night, I was like, oh, it's cool. It's kind of, it's there under the surface. They're teasing it. That's nice. And then I woke up this morning and just to kind of get to it, because I don't want to tease it any longer, we actually get to the climax of
which
the movie.
Which is excellent.
Excellent. It's very good. And just like the film itself, you know, which hides the Beatles' faces, and it's about, you know, what is not seen, the tease being in a way more provocative than seeing that. Because you have this big Beatles experience where he cleverly is like putting the camera behind monitors where you're seeing the original Beatles footage being played, but it's cutting off, you know, the heads of the guys who are playing in sync with it all in camera. It's beautiful. Yeah. Love it. But in that same way, we get to finally see these girls get fucking laid. And of course, and what I love is know is that for like for Super Fangirl, it's perfect in the sense that is for her, it's about taking care of business, just like she's fucking Bradley Cooper. She passes out immediately misses the done. Entire thing, and
then
when people tell
up,
her that,
no, wakes up and yeah, faints
yeah.
again.
Yeah, wakes up. Yeah, that's right. That's a good moment. But the best part is the reaction at the end is they say like you fainted, missed the whole thing, and she's like yeah, because like it doesn't matter.
It was perfect. It was perfect.
It was a notch in her bedpost. She got but. What's insane is with like is almost more explicit than the guitar fucking scene is the scene with Nancy Allen at the end,
just standing
where she says yes because the whole thing is like she just is trembling and then the whole and saying Paul and she's not for whatever reason she's not caught up in the maelstrom, she's like she's by herself
sitting closing her eyes
so that she's close, she's crying and she's heaving when all these girls are passing out and all this stuff, and then finally and she's just literally saying Paul and it literally feels like and is shot like it has like that kind of, almost like it has a, like a soft focus almost like it's the scene where like he's bedding her in a hayloft or something like that, like this is her looking up at the stars while he's on top of her, and then finally when the film couldn't possibly make it this is one of those great shots that where it's like the film was loaded so much meaning and so much subtext that all they have to do to climax the film, to essentially say that Nancy Allen has now gone from, preferring Edgar to Heathcliff, to choosing the Phantom of the Opera, to going to the Beast, instead of Gaston, to the dark side, the sexual side, which is in itself this new thing, whatever. It's all literally one shot, and it doesn't even achieve it with a camera movement. The camera stays still, all that happens is she stands. So it goes from her, it literally goes from her face, tears, crying, it goes from her head, the Apollonian, to as she stands, the Dionysian, as it stands, and literally her crotch enters the frame, and you see her trembling hands grab her skirt and fold it towards, between her trembling thighs.
Yeah,
and that's the point when it got to, I was like, that was my kind of holy shit moment. I was like, God damn, they really went for it. They like fucking...
There it is.
But it's great because it's subtle. It just requires literally on set or whatever, it just requires Nancy Allen to stand. It requires a lot more than that. But it's just, what I love is the simplicity of it. She's just standing up. The camera's still. And yet, everything that the movie is that one shot. It goes from the head to the crotch, loins. To the loins. It goes from the head to the loins. It goes right in there. It shows you. It shows you her fucking legs. It shows you. But it basically is about her coming, Richard. It's about her.
Yeah.
And it that whole explosion there is just all in that one subtle movement where she stands there. And it's like it. And it finally. And that's the anyway. It's just a cool thing. I'm trying to think of a good analog. I mean, there's plenty of other films that have a similar kind of trajectory, but I just love
how explicit it gets. Like, it's right way over the line that you thought it had. Like, and it does that a handful of times where you think the line is in one place, and it, like the jumping out of the car, you think the line is in one place, and then the movie like leaps over it and defines a new line.
Yes, that's fun. Yes, that's a good way to look. But I love it's just. I love that it has this fantastic integration on a bunch of levels with the idea of even the, and I kind of touched on it a couple times before, but okay, so the entire film is about this tease towards climax. But the fact that integrates so well both with the themes about, whatever, sexual revolution bursting out of blah, blah, blah. But it also just works with on a media level with just the fact that, well, Beatles songs are fucking expensive and hard to get. And so we'll have a little bit at the beginning to tease you. And then we're going to build towards this Beatlemania explosion at the end where you finally this, Beatles experience where the whole movie has made you anticipate how awesome the Beatles are and think and remember how rad the Beatles were. And then it finally kind of explodes. So it's just the fact that the themes are integrated with, all of the characters on their little sexual journeys of sexual awakening, which is in itself integrated with this plot of them all headed to the Beatles, which in itself was integrated with just the idea of the media itself, the Beatles catalog being this thing we're going to tease you with and then kind of make you come with at the end of the movie.
Right. Even for an
really
audience.
Cool thing.
From an audience, the audience's journey too, right?
Yes.
Like you start watching
that's
the movie.
That's what I mean.
The audience is so beautiful because when watching it, when you do get to the climax, like it's like surprising. Like you're like, how are they going to pull this movie out? Like, yeah. How does this end? And like the sexual stuff is like bonkers, crazy, wonderful. Yeah. But even just like the music playing and the shots of the screaming girls, mm-hmm. and the cleverly hiding of the Beatles with mm-hmm. the Ed Sullivan footage, just one to one as a cinematic experience, and is a just
which of course you know
wonderful.
And then of course it kind of goes without saying in all the ways that this is a prelude to, you know, all the historic footage integration in Forrest Gump, which you then see. It's like there's so many seeds of so many Zemeckis things in this,
including this is, I didn't know this, but they made a huge deal about it in some of the special features, is the sync on those monitors, on the TVs. That was the first time it was done without that big black bar. Like, they figured out how to do the TV playback.
Oh, nice, nice,
in camera for this movie. So even if we are looking ahead to all of the special effects stuff, mm-hmm. like, even with this first one, there is a one enormous crucial element that came together for the movie.
For someone who's going to spend a significant portion of the later part of his life interested in exploring new film technologies, yes, that is very interesting to think about.
Movie one,
yeah,
it's there.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, yeah, and what's great, I'll tell another quick story that I heard off the thing, so you don't have to listen to it. But obviously you will, Kyle. But that end sequence... it took them forever to get the rights to the Beatles songs, right? They took them 9 months to get rights. Then they could write the screenplay. But the thing was, as they were making the movie, is they were...
And tell me more about how it came together, because I don't know very much about, like, because it's the thing.
They pitched to female executives at Warner Brothers, or to producers at Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. So it was just a treatment. American Graffiti meets Ben-Hur. It's Girl Trip. So they pitched the female producers. They had it set up at Warner Brothers, but Warner Brothers had a no first-time directors policy, so Zemeckis wasn't going to direct it because of Brian De Palma. Brian De Palma's first film like instituted that policy, so Zemeckis couldn't direct it at Warner Brothers. then they had decided that they were basically sitting on it, and Spielberg was telling Zemeckis that you should direct this. And so he went to Universal, called the big boss at Universal, mm-hmm. set it up at Universal, mm-hmm. and then had like his agent call Warner Brothers mm-hmm. to have Warner Brothers let it go to Universal so Zemeckis could direct it, because Universal said, yes, we're a go picture if you get the rights. Mm-hmm. So Spielberg's agent gets the rights from Warner Brothers. Yeah. They make it, they press go. Then they make the movie, but they're told that you can't use any of the actual footage of the Beatles, and you can't use the Ed Sullivan Show. You can't use the archival footage. And so they were like, oh God, when are we ever going to get a chance to make a movie? We have to do what they say. And they were like, no, we have to see the Beatles. They were insistent. No, we have to see the Beatles. We have to see the Beatles. It doesn't work without it. But they were told they couldn't do it, so they did it without it. And then they screened the movie for the Universal executive, who said, guys, you're right, you have to see the Beatles here. And so they reached out to the Ed Sullivan Show, and the Ed Sullivan Show said, yes, you can use it, you can use the footage, but you have to indemnify us, because they didn't get rights to it. The legal team was like, don't let him do it, don't let him use it, the Beatles are going to sue us. And the studio head says,
so they got approval from the Ed Sullivan Show, but not from the
Beatles, right? And so, and Universal had the music rights, which is how they ended up clearing. They had access to clear the music rights, apparently. Mm-hmm. But it comes back. The movie is shot, finished, edited, not working. The end isn't working. The head of the studio, I forget his name, goes against the legal team's advice and says, fuck it.
Interesting.
Put it in the movie. Here's a budget. Go reshoot it with the footage. And if the Beatles do sue us, then I'll be the guy who got them all in the same room together, because they had broken up at that point.
And then I'll bust out a dube, and we'll all start talking about our feelings.
And then
reunite,
he said,
the Beatles, man. He was on a lot of cocaine. He was on a lot of cocaine.
He said, "Fuck it. If it goes bad, I'll be the one who reunites the Beatles, and I'll have the rights to the Beatles reuniting." So he said, "Fuck it," and then they got the money to go do it, which is crazy.
There's a cocaine subtext, I think, to all of this.
It was the 70s.
Definitely cocaine fueled. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
That's true. It might have been a little early for cocaine. I don't know the history of cocaine, Richard.
The confidence level of Spielberg, though, in like getting the movie made is enormous. Like, he went and like violated the DGA rules by telling Universal that if Zemeckis was fucking up, he would step in, which is a huge no-no of the DGA.
Yeah.
But so many times, like, Spielberg made the movie happen. It was his first time executive producing. He went on a huge limb. The movie cost like $2.5 million back then, which is not nothing.
Yeah. So Spielberg goes out on a limb to help birth this thing into existence.
Yeah.
And awesome. Yeah, that makes so much wonderful sense. It is interesting, though.
Beautiful story. Like, the kind of story that you wish you heard more of today. Like, somebody like taking swings for somebody else, and even the studio. This is a wonderful. I love this detail. Like, the movie tanked at the box office. They didn't put any money behind marketing it. They didn't release it very well. And of course, Zemeckis is nervous. Right? He's like, he thought he's blown his one shot, because the movie tested really well. The movie tested really well, but bombed at the box office. And he like went into the office on a Sunday, got the phone call about the box office receipts, and was just depressed. And the studio head at Universal calls him, and Zemeckis is like, "Oh God, I'm so sorry, man. I'm so sorry." And the guy goes, "Here's what you do. I want you to go home. I want you to pour yourself a whiskey. And I want you to start on the next one, because I screened it at my house for my girls. We all loved it. I'm proud to be a part of it. Let's start working on the next one," which apparently is Used Cars.
Right on. Which we'll talk about on the next episode. Or
yeah.
Two.
Anyway, yeah, I love all the stories behind it. It's like, it makes the movie better.
Well, it ultimately, obviously for a lot of reasons, makes sense, you know. So very interesting. The thing about this was Spielberg's first executive producing thing. That makes it very significant, considering he ended up being very good at that for a very, very long time. So this is interesting, being his first swing was for old Bobby Z. We're doing a podcast about him right now, Richard.
There's actually a great moment on the commentary where I felt he was speaking directly to you and I, when Zemeckis goes, "For those of you students,"
he said,
"of
put
my work,
your dick away, Richard."
I mean, he's like, "For the all those students of my films out there," and I was like, "Is that us? That's us."
I know. I think we are officially the first students of his films.
That's what I. Is that us? We're the first.
We are indeed. But it makes a lot of sense also that, you know, Spielberg. This is Spielberg's first executive producing thing. Because what do you do when you suddenly when you're suddenly successful and you're trying to make things happen? You try and push things into the world that you want to see. And Spielberg, obviously, without getting into too much depth, is often, you know, credited with this new optimism coming out of the 70s that would largely characterize the films of the 1980s. And you see that in the end of this film, where you see, and that's in a way in which it has an ending that is in a lot of ways fundamentally very similar to Back to the Future. And in a way, Back to the Future feels very, very much of its time, and this feels oddly, I would say, ahead of its time, but considering it tanked to the box office, potentially before its time or out of time relative to the era in which it was released, in the sense that
it's an 80s film.
Yeah, but in this, exactly, 100%, 100%. It's an 80, and the reason that is because, again, you can see that Spielbergian and certainly Zemeckisian, we'll say, we need to figure out the right version of that word if we're going to keep doing this podcast. But you see that kind of moral order and optimism in the architecture of that whole ending, where it's, you know, there's a moral order to the universe, but that was present in the films of the 70s and stuff, but you would see, you know, the people have that moral victory, but in the material world, you know, Butch and Sundance get gunned down at the end of the movie.
Even American Graffiti, Graffiti is about like getting through the night, and it's like this cautious, I don't even remember that movie ending with too much optimism. Everything is ending, they're going out, and it's not this like rah-rah.
It has a lights going out on a thing.
Right.
And that's the thing, whereas this is a celebration of something that is sort of arriving, that, you know, but even in the end, specifically in this moment where you see the girl make, I'm going to call her Sally Meatballs with the photography, because I don't know anyone's names, Richard.
I love her.
I don't understand how
Janice is her name. Janice is her name in the movie.
Yes, I have, you know, I can do things, Richard, but not names.
That's true. Every film festival we've been to proves that to me.
Yes, that is true. Richard is a person from before.
Who's that?
Yes, exactly. Who's that? Who's that, Richard? What is that person's name?
What they do? Why do I know them?
Kyle, you have met them 18 times.
I feel like I'm the Tony Hale character in Veep at film festivals with you, just kind of standing behind you, like whispering who people are constantly. Like, oh, this is them. They did this movie last year.
Just like Matt Damon in Sizing, just sneaking into the frame, being very also inebriated and intoxicated. But what I mean by this is when Sally Meatballs is she makes her choice to go be with Jimmy Olsen. She has the ticket. She's about to go in. She decides to give up the ambitions, to give up her goals and go be with Jimmy Olsen. But instead, this is in 1978, which is interesting because this is much more of an 80s thing. It's not Forget It, It's Chinatown, where she, you know, decides ultimately what happens. We now live, this film exists in a universe where when you make the right choice, you are rewarded not just the moral victory, but also materially, in the sense that who runs out, the Beatles jump into the back of her car, and she presumably gets her big exclusive interview with the Beatles that's going to skyrocket her.
She's going to sell the Life magazine.
Exactly. And then this is especially interesting. And then, of course, Nancy Allen thing, she says, this doesn't help her appreciate some greater thing with her boyfriend. She says, fuck it to that guy, and she gets bucked by Paul.
I love that as the decision she has to make, and it's the line of dialogues are very explicit. Yeah. It's like, no, you're marrying me tomorrow. No, I would rather go see the Beatles.
Yeah, no, seriously,
it's like on the nose.
Yes. And that's that. But
it works.
But here's the thing. But think about this. Think about how that's the same thing that even I think some people maybe are weird about with regard to Back to the Future, which is the idea that, you know, there's this big moral victory. We have an echo literally of a line. I mean, obviously conceptually it's very similar. It's a portal in time, both things, this the similar line being, I'm going to, you know, take your goddamn hands off of her from Jimmy Olsen, as a prelude to Crispin Glover. But basically, you have the situation where, because Marty McFly, again, another lightning bolt at the end of that movie, gets the moral victory, he's rewarded not just with returning to his family as they were before, but now with a renewed appreciation. So he doesn't need the big truck. He doesn't need the boat. He doesn't need the accolades or whatever. Like, instead of that ending, which again would fit certainly much more comfortably in 1978, I'm talking about Back to the Future here, came in the mid-80s, he's instead rewarded with, you know,
the big truck,
the dad is rich, and all of this kind of stuff. There is basically this there's metaphysically a different orientation to these films than the films of the 1970s, in the sense that it's like, it's that idea that if you're that kind of Horatio Alger optimism, that if you do right, you will be rewarded in this world. I mean, for Christ's sake, we have to start talking about that, because this is the man who made Forrest Gump, literally the film about if you just do right, you will be rewarded, in the sense that Forrest Gump doesn't just like lead a life of quiet monastic peace where he comes to realizations about stuff. He like becomes like a billionaire by the end of it. So again, but it's cool all the way at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's not about the girl, Sally Meatballs, turns around and goes and gets in the car with Jimmy Olsen, and they have a moment, and she gets the moral victory, and she realizes the material stuff was not part of it. She gets both and hard, and she gets way more because she was a good person. She gets way more money and success than she ever would have got before. And you see that here, which feels out of almost, and again, I wasn't alive then, but it feels, but relative to the period, it feels very, very new coming out of the 70s, 1978, and it feels something that would so characterize not just the 80s, but would character, and again, not just Zemeckis' films, but Trading Places. What happens? They don't realize being rich isn't important at the end of Trading Places. Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd end up on a yacht, you know, feeling good, Lewis, looking good, Billy Ray. And so that's, it's interesting to see that here already showing up in this movie. So cool.
He's an optimist, I guess.
I know, but that's the thing, is that
it's beautiful. I think,
but what's interesting about this being in 1978 And even thinking about how it came out very similar to around the same time as Eraserhead, and how David Lynch was on this other completely alternate trajectory, kind of dealing with in some ways with some of the same juxtapositions, is you see that it's just to look at the career of Bob Zemeckis as potentially just to look at the introduction of this thread of optimism, of not just moral optimism, but moral and material optimism being seeded here in 1978. And it being too early, both, which is literally characterized by him not making money on this fucking movie, or it's, you see that in that. And then later on, you know, when Back to the Future arrives, which shares many elements in common with this film, it's a goddamn bomb that goes off and just people are fucking there for it. So I don't know. It's really, this was an awesome little treasure trove to start off the whole Bobby Z podcast, because Richard, he is not a butthead.
He's not a butthead. This movie's
certainly not a butthead after this movie.
It's so good. It's really good.
It's a handsome looking movie too. All the cars. I mean, I realize that's a big part of the whole, like, it's, you know, fucking blah de da is all the nostalgia of the cars racing around. But those scenes, like where they're driving around, he's jumping and Smirko. I mean, we can talk more about Smirko too. And just again,
oh, we didn't talk about the barber scene. The whole barber sequence.
Oh yeah.
Oh,
what
God.
Is that fucking kid? And it's killing me. I was going through his, like, I know he's in something that I've seen it a bunch, and I couldn't place him. I could have looked it up, but I didn't. But what I like, his whole trajectory with Joan Baez chick is really interesting, because it's about his revolution is just the hair. Just about the kid. I feel like that's probably the little Bob Zemeckis right there, isn't it? It's like the boy, and his little revolution is just his hair.
Cut
and
your damn hair!
I know. What I like also is, again, everything's at 10 in this movie, is how angry and terrifying his dad is with regard to that hair. And that's great. And it's the kind of thing where it also feels in a different way, very similar to what Spielberg was doing there's a lot of synergy between Zemeckis and Spielberg, but it's interesting to see how they achieve these things differently. That's why I keep bringing up Spielberg so much. But in the same way that, you know, Spielberg would ground you with the kid's perspective in E.T., it's interesting to see he does it just by making the dad's performance so goddamn terrifying and the making that dad so unsympathetic and so mean looking that you feel like that boy. You're like, God damn it, this is a fucking horror movie, this barbershop with
favorite
the fucking
line.
Eye patch.
I have a story for that. Yeah. So first, like, my favorite line of the movie is in that scene when the barber goes, "What do you want, kid?" And the dad, just staring evilly at him, goes, "I want him to look like a Marine.
I want him to look like a Marine."
Yes, love that delivery. It's perfect.
It's funny to think, it's kind of funny to think about, Bob. I guess kind of being this, just this thought's occurring to me now, in the same way that other filmmakers coming out of the late 70s into the 80s would usher in this new everything turned up to 10 visual aesthetic. Your Tony Scotts and your Ridley Scotts who would basically come out of the world of television commercials and say, we pumped the amount of juice we pump into these little television commercials, like the Apple commercial, into an entire feature film, and every goddamn shot looks like it's a goddamn Nike advertisement or a goddamn recruitment ad or a goddamn thing. And it's just like, so that's an interesting visual trajectory going into the 80s. But it's interesting to think of Bob Zemeckis in terms of just performance, energy, optimism.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think of that, these big, just the amount of energy, everything turned up to 10 all the time, even that dad. And then thinking about the relationship between that and, like, just seeing those big cartoony principal figures, whether Twisted Sister music video in the 80s or in a John Hughes movie, you know, the bull and the horns and all that, some of those big cartoony things coming. And again, it feels
even
like
just
a film.
The principal in Back to the Future. It's the same thing.
And again, it's not to say that wasn't present in, there wasn't a bunch of just goofy shit present in spades all throughout that era, but I'm trying to pinpoint what it is about it, and what I think it might just be the optimistic orientation of the film as a whole. Because you take the same film and you just change some fundamental story elements, but you have a lot of the same running around and everything, and it would feel much more comfortable just being a goofy movie from that era, from the era it was in. But the the big, like, all of the endeavors of the kids pay off. They all get what they want. They all explode with sexual joy, but they all still can go home to their parents at the end because no nipples or anything were shown. They took it right to the line and
actually
came back.
That's not true.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
There's a nipple in the film, and I only saw
it belongs to Jimmy Olsen.
I listened to the commentary.
It's that scene where Smarco has him on his knees, and he's just slapping him in the face, and he's saying, "You're a bitch, show me your nipple," and he just shows him his nipple.
It's better than that. You're going to want to go back and find this moment. It's when her boyfriend is introduced. It's just standing there in a wide shot, and he's like got his hand on like a wooden woman. Uh-huh. There's like a woman built into like the banister that he's leaning on.
Wait, who are we talking about again? Sorry,
Nancy Allen's boyfriend.
Oh, yeah,
he first shows up in the movie. He's standing in this wide medium shot. There's a bust of a woman right next to him, and he's like standing there staring at her, and you're staring at his face, and what you don't know is his hand is twisting the nipple of that sculpture. And it's like blink and you miss it, but oh my god, when I like went back and watched that, and it's like holy shit, like it's like there is a nipple and he's twisting it in the shot.
Yes, he is twisting that's so great because it seeds in right in his opening shot the nature of the relationship between him, which he is sort of like just complete dominance over her sexually, which is to say he has ownership over her sexuality in that car ride as she's there. But how can she go back to Edgar? How can she go back to the nerd?
To Mr. Lupus.
How can she go back to whomever, lame fucking boyfriend, when she fucking got the Paul's just long, thick bass? She got to touch it. She got that fucking long, thick bass. And then at the end, she gets out. And it's that's the thing, is that she literally gets out of the car not to be with her friends. She's alone during.
Yeah.
Like, it's not she the doesn't shots
know,
during.
She doesn't know that they're going to be there.
She doesn't even know they're going to be there. And in her shots, it's not about, and I'm sure if this from a film from just a few years later, and this is why it's this interesting thing that feels like it's bridging that Zemeckis optimism from the 80s with the 70s, is that she, like, you could see a different version of this movie where there's all three of them, and they're all smiling together with their hands on their, over each other, and they're saying, "We're seeing the Beatles.
We
did it!" And they're all unified in a frame together, and it's about togetherness and friends. That is not what that frame is about with Nancy Allen at the end. She is alone. She is conspicuously alone, considering how many people are crammed in there. But she is conspicuously alone in her frame, and she is just getting hammered, which means that her reason, what she's wrestling with when she's getting out of the car with her boyfriend, is not, "I want to be with my friends," or "my friends will be disappointed." Her friends have no fucking idea, which, like, they don't give a shit. Their mind is on the Beatles. Again, this is so much more similar to a guy's going out to get laid movie, which is, interesting to think about in itself. But because she's not thinking about any of that, it is just about, and again, you can kind of feel it has a male, almost a male orientation, this film, because it's just about, she is horny as fuck. She got a taste of it in that room, but she didn't get to go to completion. And now she's looking at that concert. There it is, the light in the window, finally getting taken to completion. And she looks at her lame ass, shitty boyfriend, and she gets out of the car, and she gets there, and she's like, "Oh, my friends are here. Who gives a shit? Whatever. They pass out, they go away." And she gets everything that she wants, which is just to get fucked by Paul McCartney's music. And then again, to circle back to it, because I think it's worth discussing at least twice, finally to that shot where she stands up from the head to the loins, from the fucking, from her teary face of romantic affection, that's still chaste, to something that is decidedly unchaste when she stands up. And I just touch it, and then it's like that moment where that just we just touch the subtext, that third rail for a second, we just touch it, and then the film starts receding. It's like the wave begins to roll back right from that moment.
Well, you have, and Brad, it's like it's building. It builds to that so beautifully, because you have her in the room where you get the movie crosses a line there, and you're like, "Whoa, this is different than I thought." And then we haven't talked about the photographer like dressing up as the sexy woman to go have sex with the man to get the $50, and you have the movie also is like just steps over a line completely in that shot down the hallway too, where you're like, "Holy shit, she's going to go do it." And then she hesitates. And then that's the line cross where you're like, "Oh, she was going to go do that thing." Yeah, and then you have the shot where she like walks away, looks at the Beatles on a newspaper, and decides she's gonna go do it. She's gonna go have sex with that weird dude.
And that's so interesting because she is not interested in. Because she's not interested in it's not about Beatlemania for her. It's about ambition.
But
my point being is that because her orientation from the beginning is about ambition, it's the only one that's kind of asexual in nature. So then it's so interesting to, that's why the film feels like it so comes together so well at the end, is because then how do you integrate this element of sexuality to someone who doesn't really seem to have a sexual interest in the Beatles? The element of sexuality is introduced because it's about all. It becomes a question just of integrity. What are you willing to do to get your ambition to get what your ambitions are telling you that you want?
Right.
And that just ties her thing then in. And that's when you get her thing, which has not been about sexuality at all at that point, is where you then get that wonderful image that's similar to Blue Velvet, where she's watching the thing that, you know, the whole patty cake
she's
moment.
She's in there for a long time.
She sure is.
She
watches him put a lot of mustard on his head or whatever the fuck is going on there. It feels like the first dumb, it feels like the first draft version of the patty cake gag. Yeah. I mean, that's literally what it is. But it's so interesting how the first draft version of the patty cake gag from Roger Rabbit essentially is way more similar to that scene in Blue Velvet than it should be, because it with a lot of, and I think that's what's nice, and that's again why the film is this interesting thing that bridges, it feels like it bridges the 70s and the 80s in this interesting way, is because it's like it leaves you with a lot of time to think about the idea of Sally Meatballs watching like a girl her age who's dressed exactly like her getting railed by this fat old guy.
There was another story
for sure.
There's a story about that scene. The studio saw.
I love that you know things about this movie.
I'm glad I got the disc. The studio saw it. The executive saw it and was like, "It would be better if they were just having sex." The mustard thing is so deviant.
No, you were fucking right. Yeah, no, I mean, I kind of told, like that's in that way. If we didn't even talk about it up to this point, like in that way, it is weirdly more similar
so
to the David Lynch thing because
weird.
Yeah, no, yes. It's because it's literally it's uncanny in that it resembles sexuality, but because it's not any kind of sexuality our minds can process, it feels unknown and uncanny and even scarier somehow. It's like that old Patton Oswalt joke about saying, "I want to fill your hoo-ha with goof juice."
Yeah,
it's way scarier than saying, "I want to fuck your pussy," because just not saying it is weird.
But even in that, the movie's about sexual revolution. And so it fits in all of the different pieces, and then he gets blackmailed into giving her the $50, and she doesn't have to have sex with him.
Yeah, and then he fucking goes for her at the end. That was a surprising amount of violence to introduce right there. Again,
and then Jimmy Olsen bursts in right there in the same shot,
like in the background of that shot, like she chased her over to the thing, and then boom, he bursts in, "Get your damn hands off her." And it's just interesting to look at that style as compared to the much more constructed cinematic style that same beat would be handled with in Back to the Future, because you can see him maturing visually as well. Because here, I love these big master shots. It's very campy. It's this cool throwback thing where, you know, a lot of different people running around the frame, people popping up out of doors and under beds and all sorts of shit. And it's cool. But then you think about that same beat in Back to the Future and how that reflects just a different era where, you know, shot of Crispin Glover's POV, low angle looking up and all that. And again, it's much more central character, so it's worth that amount of cinematic weight. But at the same time, you see his style evolve from this kind of interesting throwback style to something that's much more grounded in the visceral, subjective cinema. This kind of that was just this fucking concentrated shit that was going to be coming just a couple years later.
Right. And you see elements of what he's of those moments in the shot that you're talking about, when she just stands in the frame, where that shot is all about her experience.
Yeah,
right?
Oh, yes, for sure.
About her experience. And the pullback in the room is all about that. And even some of the the big, I'm going to marry Paul or John. I'm going to marry John. Well, he's married. That whole thing transitions into a gag where the mm-hmm. protester steps in and then she gets ushered away. And it's all this one big master. So like all of the puzzle pieces for him like are present there in the first thing.
We haven't talked about the trajectory of the super fan and Eddie Deason, who, if you don't know Eddie Deason, he's the guy who talks like this, who was in like Critters 2 and Critters 2.
But he's that guy. You know him when you hear him. When you hear his voice, you're like, oh, that guy.
But his trajectory is, well, I guess he's the super fan who's selling Beatles merch and ripping up the carpet and all of this sort of thing.
AstroTurf.
Yeah. Yeah, and I just love this idea that it's like he's not necessarily gay, but he's definitely not interested in her sexually. So it's almost like her kind of, it's almost in one way, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, say this, I don't know if there's anything to support this, but there's an idea that it's almost like this emergent idea of, oh, I can have friendships with men who don't have interest in me sexually. It's kind of like having a gay BFF in that she says, I finally have a boy I can talk to, but there's nothing sexual about their communication. It's only they can only talk to each other about the Beatle,
right?
About sex stuff.
Yeah, and I think if you that goes
because
back,
that's like, what the Beatles are.
She says
sex stuff.
Well, she introduces him to her friends as her boyfriend.
Yeah.
And then he immediately turns that back to her.
Yes.
And it's like, you're not a real fan because you love Paul and you only jump ship when someone better comes along. Referring to himself, so he himself is like rebuffing the kind of a romantic relationship with her, and then of course they come back together and go see the show.
She's cheating on Paul with him. Yes, I love all that. Yeah.
And he chastises her for it.
I got to say, and I don't understand how technology or how GIFs work, Richard. But I feel like if we do anything with this podcast, is you need to make GIFs. Out of every shot of Nancy Allen getting railed by Paul McCartney's music at the end, because every shot is gold. So especially the one, you know, because we need
I know
reasons.
The one. I can probably do that for you.
Rockin'. We can create GIFs, Richard. Technology is amazing. We're in two different cities talking to each other.
Power.
We do, Richard. Oh man.
I loved this movie.
It was the perfect movie to start off with in this whole thing, because you see so much of what is to come in this, which in a weird way, it's just kind of fun to see the origins of a filmmaker and then see so much of what's going to pop up later in its kind of infancy, because it just allows, especially for someone, I think this is the case for both of us, who kind of grew up watching Back to the Future and grew up watching a lot of his movies. It almost doesn't feel like it was a time when I don't remember Back to the Future, and therefore it's difficult without, unless we really want to just take some heavy psychedelics, which I'm up for, Richard. It's difficult to get a new orientation.
We'll do that for the walk. The walk.
Oh, there you go. Oh, Jesus. Oh, right. Because and it's also it's important to remember that he needed to synchronize all of his time with Back to the Future because he needed to predict 9/11, and we're getting to that eventually.
We'll get
Richard.
To that.
We'll get to that eventually.
I know. I know.
Yes, but the point being, Richard, what were we talking about a second ago? I've lost track. Oh, it's different. It's difficult to get a new orientation to, like, how do I start looking at Bob Zemeckis as a director, as a voice, rather than just as the amalgamation of all these films. And this was the perfect sort of Rosetta Stone, because I'm like, oh, a career that begins with this movie, I can see so much of the line, obviously, to Back to the Future and to Forrest Gump and to so much of what, and to Roger Rabbit and to so much of what's to follow. So it was kind of this cool Rosetta Stone deciphering the rest of his filmography, which is dope.
Yeah, I agree. It's the kind of thing where you're like, oh man, it's this movie that I'd never heard of. We're going to watch this and it's just we're going to have to talk about it for an hour, 90 minutes. Like, what are we going to talk about?
I know. Watch a new movie and talk about it. God.
But just something that something that seems like the bottom, like just a lost, weird thing.
There was an undercurrent, an emotional undercurrent of, okay, let's get this one out of the way so that we can get to Used Cars and we can get to Back to the Future. We can get those. This will be like a tune-up episode. And instead, I I found myself actually stopping to write things down during this episode, which is something, because Richard, you know that I don't like researching stuff
preparing
or writing stuff down. But it was about the time like the lightning bolt hit. I'm like, there's so many fun Bob Zemeckis Easter eggs in this and so much cool stuff. I feel like there's huge swaths of this movie that we haven't talked about that we're forgetting, but I feel like we've really nailed a lot of it.
Yes. I want to bring up two things. One about you. I thought of you when I heard this, another story from the disc.
Were they talking about really handsome gentlemen?
No, they were talking. Okay. Kyle, of course, hates filling out any sort of forms or paperwork.
Yes.
Give him an anxiety that is enormous.
I do not like writing. Yes, I have huge
official forms.
Reaction.
Official forms, like, it just, he can't do it.
Can't process them. No.
And so on this movie, somebody told Zemeckis he had to join the DGA.
That sounds like a nightmare to me.
So he called the DGA.
How much documents?
And no, he called the DGA and he was like, "Hi, I'm directing a movie I'm supposed to join." And then apparently on the other line, the lady said, "You can't just call and say you're directing a movie and get into the DGA." And then she hung up. And then he was like, "I guess I'm not joining." And so he did this movie, Used Cars and Romancing the Stone, not a member of the DGA. And then when he did Back to the Future, his agent was like, "Hey, so I talked to the DGA and they have you listed as dead and you have residual checks." And he was like,
How did you get to dead all of a sudden from not having ever been?
I don't know.
That's the DGA's logic, basically. How could this man possibly have directed three films without being a member of our organization? He must be dead.
Yeah. So they think you're dead. And he's like, "Oh, I just never joined." And he's like, "You should join. There are a bunch of residuals for the movies that you made. There are checks waiting for you.
Do you want money?
Join the DGA."
And can so I has money him, now?
It took him to Back to the Future to join the DGA. But I thought of that. Thought of you when I heard that story.
Rad. No, that is the level I think at which I approach like most documents I have to fill out. Yeah. It's just like, "Oh God." And then like I try for a second, I'm like, "There's no point." And then I go away.
And I do want to go back to the barbershop sequence. Because it turns into a fucking horror film. At that moment, with the great shot of like his eyes slowly being raised into frame with
it's Bob Zemeckis at his most Joe Dante in this.
And that actor, you mentioned the guy, because I wrote it down too. Like, you introduce the barber who takes down the newspaper only to have an eye patch, smoking with an eye patch. And it's like, this is the most terrifying image. What's funny is that's the AD for the movie. The actor that was cast as the barber, he has an eye patch. That guy just has an eye patch. But the actor that was cast to play the barber showed up drunk 5 hours late. And they were lit and rehearsed. The AD pulled out his SAG card and said, "Every good AD is a member of SAG." And then he goes, "I'll do it." And then jumped in and performed that scene.
Wow. I love that has such an AD energy to it when you think about it. It's like, "All right, I need to just make the movie happen, keep everything on schedule, and if need be, I will jump on screen, play a role, and do it admirably."
And the him slipping on the gumballs was not in the script. That was his idea. He's like, "Just give me the pay bump. I'll for the stunt. I'll do it."
Oh,
and
were such a nice touch too. Because again, it's something and it's an object that so evokes like that previous era that's being smashed, and it adds that such a great visual punch to him falling over. The stunt would have been so lame if he had just plopped onto the ground. And it's not just that he breaks something; he could have broken a vase, but that's not enough. Everything in this movie has to be 10. He breaks a machine full of gumballs, so the colorful gumballs are just scattering and bouncing and moving everywhere. Again, everything up to 10. And it pays off because it's a very loud and colorful and a movie. But I love that sequence with the barbershop and the whole thing. It's a very dope and very cool and very, scary. And
Want him to look like a Marine.
I want him to look like a Marine.
Do you have that two shot with just the two of their heads, the barber's head and the dad's head, looking down at him occasionally and giving this monologue? "I came home and I saw him from the back and I thought he was a girl." And you have the barber with an eye patch smoking going,
Yes.
Just immediately visually undercutting, making the anger a comedy.
I know, and that's and I hope we see. I feel like there's. It's feel like it exists some in plenty of places today. But that, just that goofy silliness that characterized the films of Joe Dante and Bob Zemeckis and even Sam Raimi and all, and then later on you see little wisps of it in the Coen brothers and all that kind of such. It's all that kind of stuff. It's just delightful to see that kind of stuff done well. Yeah, you know,
I didn't know this before, but Bob, the Zemeckis and Gale are both from the Midwest, which makes sense. And Raimi's from Michigan, and so you have these like the kind of the silly big like comedy lowbrow stuff is coming out of like the middle of the
country. Where are they from again? I looked down and I took my
somewhere in the Midwest. I don't know quite where, but they
Richard,
they,
you are supposed to be prepared for this podcast, look, an entire podcast about Bob Zemeckis,
speaking,
and you don't even know.
Speaking, this is a Bob Gale. He said the Midwest. They're both from the Midwest. That's all you need to know. Middle
this
of the country.
This is a quarantine podcast, folks. It was thrown together. I promise, Richard,
no
will
excuse.
Be more. I
no
promise
excuse.
You. I'm sorry to disappoint you.
I watched all the things.
I'm sorry to disappoint you. I promise Richard will be more prepared next time. I promise. I'm sorry to disappoint you, everybody.
Yes. But just the growing up with the television and the Three Stooges and just silly things and them glomming to the silly things and then going to Hollywood and being like, this is funny. Like, we should do this.
Oh, for sure.
He's going to hit garbage with the car 5 times and it's going to be funny every time, and it is funny every time.
And that's the thing, is like, and that's the thing, is the film feels out of time to me a little bit, and I think that probably accounts for why it did not do well, in the sense that it was recalling simultaneously an era but also a type of cinema of that era that was not very in vogue. I mean, the sort of the old-fashioned that by that point, like, you know, goofy Dean Martin movies and goofy Jerry Lewis movies of, you know, and a bunch of and just a different era just a different era of a different kind of comedy, you know, much more of the Doris Day era of comedy than of the other one, the 1970s era.
My
brain's getting tired.
Comedies were made in the 1970s.
Exactly. No, but what I don't mean the goofiness, but what I mean by that's what I mean. Sorry, what I mean. Sorry, as we wind down here, but what I mean by that is there's just, I'm trying to put my thumb on it, but all of the different elements that make it feel odd that it's of 1978. You know, it's kind of like when you listen to a Bowie record from 1978, you can tell he's ahead of his time by the fact that it's like it doesn't feel like it's from that period. It feels like it's of the era that was to follow because he so influenced New Wave and a bunch of other things. And it's kind of like this. I just don't think that so many people, I think, consider the movement from the 70s to the 80s to be a regression from a golden era to a to something lower or more compromised or more commercial in the 1980s that, you know, occasions the fact that, like, occasioned by the turn to optimism, because optimism is never as cool. I just think that thing sort of underlies why the film sort of feels like it just is a couple years ahead. Anyway, I feel like I'm repeating myself, Richard, but go ahead.
I think it's, there's something to that. I mean, Spielberg had just burst onto the scene.
Burst onto the scene, this young whippersnapper.
Let's not try and get too historical, Rich. We're going to get out of our depth quickly. It's fine. just the way the camera, where the camera goes and how the camera moves and how the performances interact with the camera moving is very much of, like, very much pushing very forward. And you get elements of these big, long dolly shots, like, to the point where, like, Paul Newman was on set one day because his daughter's in the movie watching him set up that big master with the girl saying, oh, I'm going to marry John, that goes into X, Y, and Z. And he's got this big dolly track for all of these things to happen simultaneously. Yeah. And Paul Newman from Hollywood, who made a lot of movies and saw how things are historically shot was like, you're not going to shoot it that way, are you? You know? And so you have this kind of like, and then of course he shot it that way anyway, but have this kind of like, what are you doing exactly with all this stuff?
Even
the crew, like the stories of the crew being slow and him wanting to do too much or put too much dolly track down. It's like, it's pushing the limit of what the medium was.
No, for sure. And you see that everything was kind of being juiced up, because you have you just have some of those wonderful, especially when you're with the use of all of the extras filling out the frame as you kind of move into the record store, as I was talking about at the beginning, that fantastic shot that has just sort of both halves of the duality, that going out and to get laid super fan and Nancy.
That was his first shot.
Yes.
That's the first shot he did.
Okay, excellent. That's the perfect. You know what? That makes a lot of sense. Not because it's bad, but makes a lot of sense in that it feels very crucial to what the whole film is about. But just it has that wonderful crackling energy that you would, again, the wonderful crackling energy of that you would see in the frame of an era to come, where there was just all that little activity and tittering all around the edge. And it just felt, anyway, dope, cool stuff. I think we've talked this one to death, Richard.
I love this
Bob
movie.
Zemeckis.
Bob Z.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I hit all the things. That's all I
remember. Yeah, man. That's rad.
That's all I can remember.
What do we got coming up next week, Richard? What are we doing?
Used cars. We're doing used cars.
I bet we are. We're going to watch that one. It's going to be cool. I'm excited that we're doing this, Richard. We're talking about Bob Zemeckis. So make sure, what do people need to do if they want to see more of this and if they want to hear more from us, Richard?
We're at Bob Zemeckis on Instagram.
Yeah. You haven't talked about that yet. You somehow got the Instagram handle at Bob Zemeckis. That's now you.
That's now me.
That's now you. So you follow, if you follow at Bob Zemeckis, you are now following us, and mostly just Richard though.
Yeah, Kai will have access to the account, but it's on my stuff. Our website is notabutthead.com.
we didn't really unpack the title. I feel like it's not necessary. But obviously we'll get to it more in Back to the Future, but obviously it's a reference to Biff right. in Back to the Future.
Keep in mind, nobody's going to start with this episode.
This is true. They're literally all going to listen to Back to the Future. Yeah. It's going to be mothers.
I think it's important that we reference back to this one, because I have a feeling that this one's going to take continual pushing to get people to see.
For sure.
I'm happy to be that evangelist. But that's where to follow the show.
Rockin'.
I imagine we're on iTunes and Spotify and stuff.
You'll find it where podcasts are, probably just though on Apple to start, because we're not going to try too hard. And we might even start uploading these videos to YouTube and have a little bit of a YouTube presence, so there's a visual component. We don't know, Richard. We're at the beginning of this. It's a quarantine.
This sign off will get so much better.
Oh, I'm sure. I am at Mr. Kyle Bogart on the most central Instagram account on the internet. Richard, where can people find you?
I'm OLE_Richie, RICHIE on Instagram. Old Richie.
Nice. Old Richie on Instagram. Well, Richard,
we need to tell people to leave a review somewhere, because apparently that helps, and we'll read.
Yes.
We'll read the 5-star reviews on air.
Well, some people might be coming to this from the old podcast that I was on prior to this, the old SAN that I was on prior to this. We created incentives, you know, where we would do certain things if we got a certain number of 5-star reviews. Things that are Nancy Allen in I Want to Hold Your Hand levels of pornographic. And it's funny now, it's only now occurring to me, the sexual subtext of the of even the title, I Want to Hold Your Hand. I'll bet you want to hold somebody's hand. It's such a fun, it's a fun movie. I dig it. It's just, it holds it, all the pieces. It's nice. It's good.
It's a real movie. It's a real
works.
Movie, Kyle.
Yes. So maybe we should set some sort of goal or some sort of thing. If we can get up to 55-star reviews, then if we can get to 55-star reviews before we get to the walk, then certainly we should do the walk on heavy psychedelics. Richard, how do you feel about this?
Yeah, I think I can commit to that.
All right. So everyone leave a 5-star review for us on iTunes, and
we'll read
those. Get there. Yes.
We'll read those reviews online. Rockin'. So write whatever you want. I'll read them. Or cool. Kyle will read them. Or my mother will. I haven't decided
yes,
yet.
Yes, 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 yes. And maybe if you write a review and it's positive, and only if it's 5 stars, maybe we'll even read it on air. We're not sure. We're just we would just be excited to get any evidence that anyone had listened to this.
I'm reading all of them on the air.
Okay. Okay. Perfect. Well, then there you go.
They're all going to get read. Unless there's too many.
Yes. Well, Richard, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. I'm not sure we're going to have that problem right away, but you heard it here, folks. Leave us a 5-star review, and we will, and then write something, and we'll just read it right on air, just like we did in the old days. All right, Richard, this has been really fun. I have enjoyed it. How have you felt?
It's been great. I can't wait to do the next one.
Richard, sign us off.
All right, buttheads. We'll catch you next time for Used Cars.
Later, buttheads.